Okay, I think this is working, so we can begin. The topic that I've chosen for this year's five-part series is how great rabbinic personalities in our history dealt with tragedy and sad personal incidents in their life. Now, obviously, you could choose from many. Some did speak about it. We see the effect that it had on their lives. Some didn't. So I'm still researching to put it together. But today we're going to deal with the Rambam. I'm thinking of doing the Ibn Ezra, who also had tragedy in his life. The Abravanel, certainly, with the expulsion from Jews from Spain, and how it impacted their families, etc., in all different kinds of ways. And some, you can actually see it in the commentary that they wrote. And so we're going to deal with the Rambam. And by the way, on a personal level, nobody can go through life without the bumps, the bad tidings. Everybody gets it. I know when Rav Heinemann in Baltimore would get upset, not so vocally, but in a lecture afterwards, he would say it bothered him when people would visit in a shiva house and say to the person, you should never have, any sadness anymore. He says, is life possible? What are you wishing the person to die? I mean, because then they would, that's the only way they have to avoid sadness in life. There's going to be sadness in life. There's going to be joy, hopefully, and there's going to be a sadness. So, it's part of life. How we deal with it is extremely personal. I remember when Rav Soloveitchik lost his wife, and it impacted on him, no question, how could it not? But I remember one of the real Talmidim Muvhakim, a real disciple of the Rav, who went on to become a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, and he said to me that he never understood that how it dominated the Rav, that he used to go to the cemetery every week to visit his wife's grave. Every week, it was so paramount. Until, this Rosh Yeshiva tells me, until his wife died. And now he understands it. Now he understood it. I didn't understand it before. There's all kinds of situations were personal. Okay. With that said, there are four parts to this presentation. One part is a brief biographical sketch of the Rambam. What happened in his life, what kind of tragedies we're dealing with, the roller coaster ride that existed on a personal level. The second is a letter from his younger brother David, who did die on a business trip on a boat in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and he discusses it. He writes a very personal letter to his brother before he embarked on that trip. The Rambam never really wrote about this in his writings. If it weren't for the Cairo Geniza, we wouldn't have this information. There wouldn't be a lecture. The letter from David to the Rambam, his older brother, is in the Cairo Geniza with holes in the manuscript. So we are missing parts of it, but the majority of it is there. Then there is, if we close the door, it'd be good. Then there is a letter from the Rambam to a person named Yefet ben Eliyahu. That is the heart of this lecture, because there he lets it out. He lets it out exactly what happened and how it had affected him. So we know big time from that one letter, which again, until the Cairo Geniza, we didn't know so much. But with the discovery of these letters big time. Then at the very end, I'm going to quote from the Guide for the Perplexed, where the Rambam wrote a chapter on the evils that befall the human being, and you'll see that it's not stated verbatim that this is about the loss of my brother, but it is. And you can see it once you, and again, that's conjecture on our part, that we're adding two and two, but I think the arithmetic is pretty clear that two and two is four, and that'll be the final touch to this presentation. When I started doing the research, which initially you sit at your computer and you, it's amazing what you can find when you start researching, and I found references to Goitein. Goitein is one of these scholars who, I talked about him in a previous lecture years ago. He is one of those who just devoted himself to research on the Geniza in Cairo. And I'll tell you, to be, just to delve into that, you have to be a scholar. You have to be a scholar to do that research, because you have to know Arabic, you have to know Hebrew, you have to know a lot what's going on historically, you have to know so much material. You got to be a scholar before you can touch it. Then, very often, you're dealing with, you know, jigsaw puzzles, you know, putting things together, because after hundreds of years, the Cairo material is not in pristine condition. I mean, this was trash. And, you know, and consequently, it was never really preserved against the elements. So there, you gotta be a master of puzzles in order to get there. So I did find the Goitein letter, and believe it or not, the Broward County Library System, Goitein, I think his, I think it's seven volumes just on the Geniza of all his research. It's all in the Broward County System. So, but then I hit a wall, and this is where, thank God, this is what I always tell any student when you're doing research. Yeah, you gotta hit the books, you gotta hit the library, you gotta spend time on the computer, and then you gotta know somebody. Because then I contacted Professor Kellner. Menachem Kellner is a dear friend, and he's an expert on Maimonides. Used to be the professor of Jewish thought at the University of Haifa in Israel. So he wrote me back with the exact reference. I couldn't find it in the guide when I needed that reference. So I shout out to him on the tape as well for Menachem Kellner. Okay, now we can start in earnest of what's going on. The Rambam, 1135, born in Spain, dies in Cairo in 1204. Not yet reached 70, but he was in his 70th year of his life. First of all, his family was a very big yichus. His father was a judge in Spain, in the town of Cordova, and gave the Rambam a great deal of prestige in terms of the family backing. Now, in terms of rabbinics, not that all of you would know what this is, but you know, you have to have... His father was his Rebbe. There was no big yeshiva in Cordova, and he was homeschooled, basically. His father was his teacher, his Rebbe. The father, Maimon, his Rebbe was the Rimagash, and the Rimagash's Rebbe was the Rif, of Yitzchak Alfasi in North Africa. So you got a major school coming down through the father and the father's teachers. So it's not like there's no Mesorah, that he's taught, totally self-taught. You'll see how much he is self-taught, but he still has a Masorah, a tradition of scholarship that came, and the father worked on the family tree and claimed that they were direct descendants of Rav Yehuda Hanossi, which means that they were direct descendants of King David. But again, that's not going to buy you a cup of Turkish coffee, much less Starbucks. So anyway, that is the background to the Maimon family. When you take a look of the Rambam's scholarship, you'd have to say, well, he's a Renaissance man. In other words, he's self-taught as a physician, as a philosopher, astronomer, a linguist, a poet. I mean, he's extremely accomplished, and that's primarily being self-taught. At the age of 15, you see, many people always think of, well, the Rambam lived in Spain, and then he's in Cairo. Well, that's true, but there are gaps there that you got to know. The family left Spain at the age of 15. That means he didn't really spend a lot of time that you're aware of your development, but there's a tremendous influence. Now, his Spain, 1150, when he's 15 years old, for all the years, for 400 years prior to that, Spain was being ruled by the Moors. And the Moors are Muslims, but they're moderate Muslims. You don't have to take the Quran literally every detail. Now, when you think about that for a second, you have to understand that just about immediately after Muhammad's death in the 7th century, there is developing a split in Islam, similar to what we had with Karaites and Pharisees, those who are literalists and those who understood that there's got to be an oral tradition and a meaning, you don't have to take everything so literally. So you had the Moors, who were moderate, and then all of a sudden you had Almohads. Almohads were extremely literal, fundamentalist, and gung-ho, jihad, and everything. Sound familiar to you? So what's going on in the world today? Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed from the 12th century to now. So what did the Almohads do? They developed little pocket rebellions, and they did it all over. And Cordova fell to Almohad rebellion. They took over, kicked the Moors out, and they took over, and which meant that immediately on their agenda is convert to Islam or leave or we kill you. Simple choices. Nothing, you know, extravagant. It's a simple choice. And they stuck to it. This is what they did. So the majority of Jews living in Cordova and these other towns, because eventually it was spread throughout Spain, converted. Now, give them a little credit. Because, you know, in the bigger picture, we say, how can you do that? You know, they thought that just as this rebellion occurred, there'll be another rebellion. It's not possible that they could get their way. We're the rational people in the world. You're just going to give in to these fundamentalists, the extremists. Again, think of modern history, what's going on today. But that's what went on. So they thought that they would convert, you know, publicly, but privately keep their Judaism. That's why you had conversos. And eventually, how long can it last? What, a couple of years before the next wave, and then everything will be straightened out back to normal, right? There'll be a pendulum swinging, and that's all you have to worry about. Well, Maimon took his family and said he saw a different picture. He saw that the Almohads are going to take over the entire country, and this is not going to go well at all. So they left. And they packed up whatever they could pack up, and the family moved to Fez, Morocco. Soon after they arrived in Fez, the Almohads started to stage a rebellion in Morocco and in Fez. They got out of there as almost as quickly as they came. Now, by the way, every subsequent situation that I'm going to discuss here, the Rambam will never forgive these literal fundamentalists of Islam. He said, the other Muslims, the moderate Muslims, we had friendly relationships with them, we dealt with them, we were in business with them, a lot of things that went on we dealt with, there was no issue. We weren't first-class citizens, we were second-class citizens, but that's the extent of it. If you think about it, in Jewish history, if the extent of being Jewish in a non-Jewish country was, we'll leave you alone, but you're not going to get, you're not going to hold office, you're not going to, okay, at least I'm not getting persecuted. At least there's, for Jews, good, that's okay, Well, he would fault the Amahads, he would fault these fundamentalists for all the other tragedies that befell the family. Why? Because we wouldn't have been subjected to a nomadic life. Wouldn't have been subjected to all these other things that we had to do to make a living and to be, that was a problem. So he always held it against the literal readings of the Quran and these fundamentalists. So, he definitely moves ahead. When he's quite young, in his 20s, he's already published the commentary on the Mishnah. Now, he also has to grapple with Christianity. And that's for various reasons, because the Christians and the Arabs were at war constantly. You see, from the nomadic life in North Africa, Fez, and then in the mountains, even in caves that they had to dwell for a while, till they got to Israel. And they got to Israel, and everybody wants to fault the Rambam for not staying in Israel. Again, without analysis of what's going on. The Crusades had come in, the Christians took over, then the Arabs eventually kicked them out. The one who led the conquest of the Holy Land and kicked those Christian infidels out of the country was Saladin, the Sultan from Egypt. Eretz Yisrael was a wasteland. It was just destroyed. You can't have, it's one thing if you're fighting a war, but you can't be that piece of real estate and all these armies are going through fighting each other and think that everything's going to be okay. It's not. And it wasn't. So the Rambam saw a devastated Israel. So he ends up, he's got a family. I don't think he's even married at this point. But they go to Fustat. Fustat was what Cairo was called back then. And it becomes just a neighborhood of the greater Cairo of today. Is Fustat, and they end up staying, and he lived the rest of his life in Fustat. His wife died in a plague, and then his younger brother, because they were dealing with making a living, and initially maybe struggling a bit, people think that only after the brother died that the Rambam had to figure out what to do and became a physician. Research now, especially in the Geniza, has revealed, no, he was a doctor before the tragedy of his younger brother. Here he was, he became, because of his eminence in scholarship, quickly as he arrived in Cairo, he became basically the leader of the Jewish community in Cairo. He becomes a doctor, hangs out his sign, and people come. He's very successful. One of the higher-ups in government comes, and before he knows it, he's offered the position to become the private physician for the Sultan of Egypt. And the Sultan has a harem, and there are a lot of wives that drove, that they occupied the Rambam's time. You shouldn't think that he was, oh, when the Sultan calls, I'm there. You know, so I'll take care of the king. That wasn't so time demanding. What was demanding is all these women who are catering to the king, and they have issues. And I'm not talking about psychological issues. I'm talking about physical issues. Bearing children, having children, blah, blah, blah. Everything, that's what occupied his every day. He was at the palace and coming back home. And it's through the letters we see how fatigued he is. By the way, the only time he gave a shiur or gave a talk to the Jewish community was on Shabbos afternoon. It's the only time he talked. People came in the evenings for their problems and their questions, but the only time he gave any public anything was Shabbos afternoon. He didn't have time for it. He was every day at the palace. So, by the way, there's a good quote that I discovered looking for this, about when it's from Rav Hirsch in the 19th century, but it echoes something it's parenthetic to our presentation, but it's worthwhile. About Christianity. Hirsch says, Christianity is a religion invented by humanity to describe God, while Judaism is a religion created by God to describe humanity. So I really happen to like that a great deal. And from what I understand, the Rambam was into that type as well. Now we do know that from the writings of the Rambam, just to give you an idea, what's existing today in medical knowledge, he has medical writings on dermatology, pharmacology, and anatomy. So you should know that this way, way ahead of his time in terms of knowledge of the medical, especially in medical. Okay, so that's just a brief biography. Now, what's very important, I didn't mention the circumstances of the brother's death, and whether the brother was a younger brother. David was a younger brother. I don't know how many years exactly, 8, 9 years, whatever difference between them in age. When the Rambam is in Cairo, and the Rambam obviously has prestige, if not a great deal of money, but prestige, being already in the palace, having a medical profession, and being the scholar that he is. And they started investing, and he had, and David was the one who was given the money from the family to deal in gems, especially, and to merchandise and trade and be involved. So the Rambam is involved in business, but David is the guy doing it, and the Rambam is investing his money and the family money with David, and with good success. He advises David to go to the Sudan. There's a major trade city in the Sudan, and to go there, but don't go beyond that. Don't go beyond that. It's too dangerous. By the way, at that time, there were people that international travel is not exactly easy, besides the method of travel, but it's also, you got plenty of bandits and ambushers against caravans, and there's a lot of threat and danger in terms of travel. But David did the traveling and was very successful. So the Rambam tells him, David, you're taking the investment, but you need to get some of the goods. And he goes to the desert, through the desert, to the Sudan. David on his own decided that, which we'll see just now in the letter that he writes his brother, that he has to go to India. He has to go further east because the trade routes are where the action is. and the real goods that you can invest in is going to be there. That voyage was his doom. And the ship went down, and the others, I mean, he wasn't the only Jew on the boat. There were other Jews on that boat doing the same thing, and they all perished. Not only did he die, but also the money went, everything, other investors from the community, but the Rambam's, most of his investment was all gone. So what we have now is a letter from the Cairo Geniza, which is missing portions of it. But now, when the Rambam writes, he's usually writing in Arabic, what's called Judeo-Arabic. Judeo-Arabic is Arabic, but written with the aleph base of the Hebrew letters.
Oh, like Latino.
Yes. I brought one of my Sfarim. I have some responsa literature, and one of the editions that I have at home is it's got the Judeo-Arabic, the Judeo, and the Hebrew translation of it. So you can see what that language looked like of writing Arabic with Hebrew letters. That was the most common, and probably the letter from David was in that language, in Judeo-Arabic. Goitein translates it into English, and again, he's a scholar and does a great job, even trying to figure out certain things beyond. You know, like, it's not dated a year. It doesn't say which year it is. So it says, like, it's the 22nd of Sivan, which is in the middle of Ramadan. So, now we got something, because you could go on calendar search and figure out, because Ramadan keeps going around all the different times because they don't catch up with the solar calendar. So when was 22nd of Sivan in the middle of Ramadan? It's only one of 2 years. And that would be perfect. So we know that this was the trip that was the last letter they ever got from David. So they were able to figure that out. Now, by the way, you have references to everything to Ramadan. We do the same thing. You know, you're here for Thanksgiving weekend. You're here for New Year's weekend. You know, we do the same thing. Did you write down the Hebrew date? I mean, or did you just, but you're here for Thanksgiving weekend. So we do the same exact thing. So now you're doing it in order to get an accurate historical perspective as to when this letter was actually dated. So, and he and David mentions in this letter, actually, and it's all written, the other letters that the Rambam would write, as you'll see, to the letter to Yefet, is encouched in the formality of writing a letter. You know, may God bless you, this, that, and the other. It's all these, you know, the style of writing. Here it's one brother to another. There's none of that. You know, just a straight lit to my dear brother, Reb Moshe, a God be with you. David, your brother, is longing for you. May God unite me with you under the most happy circumstances. And he says, I'm writing the letter from Adhab, which is the town in Sudan, where the Rambam told him to go. He got there. There were no goods there to buy except for indigo. There was nothing. What happened? In other words, travel had been difficult, and the trade caravans didn't really come yet, or they're way late, or something else happened, and there's no goods. So I decided, and he's explaining, says David, why he decided to take the voyage to India. He says, I was on a caravan. There were several caravans going through the desert, you know, from the north down to Sudan. And he says, I didn't have a good feeling because we knew that there were ambushers. So I separated myself from the caravan, and me with my Jewish travel guide, who's basically an employee, we embarked on our own, with the animals, with our whole baggage, everything that we had. And we got through. the grace of God, we got through the desert, came to the Sudan, and we were unloading our stuff at the gates of the city when the caravan showed up that we separated. They got robbed. And they're lucky to get here alive, but their baggage, everything is gone. So God was good to me. I suffered the insecurity of traveling alone in the desert, an area where you're not familiar, knowing that there are these vagabonds in the region, but we managed to get through fine, and the caravan, which was supposed to be the protection, got schmeiced. Some died of thirst, some died sticking up for their possessions. And then David says, well, this trip didn't work out to be successful, if God protected me from the voyage in the desert, he'll protect me on the voyage at sea. And that's what you see from the letter, that he knows that his brother said, no, don't just go to the Sudan and then come back. You'll have, but they didn't realize that you could make this long trip and there's nothing there to buy, so what's it worth? So he goes and ends up making the story and tells his brother, don't worry, by the time you get this, I'll be almost in India, and everything with the grace of God will be fine. So now, despite all this, don't worry. He who saved me from the desert will save me while on sea. I'm quoting from the book, from the letter. Now, the next five lines are lost. There's a hole in the parchment. And he says, please calm the heart of the little one and her sister. This is, again, this is why you need a scholar to tell you, who's he talking about? A young wife was always referred to as the little one. And he had a daughter, right? So, which is also something that's going to be part of the Rambam's tragedy of losing his brother, losing the family wealth, but also now he's got the brother's widow and child that he's going to take care of and raise. So everything is difficult. They had these key terminology. The old one, the little one is your young wife. The old one refers to the grandmother who's the matriarch of the family and is really the one who is ruling the roost at home. You know, so again, without the scholar giving us translation and also giving us commentary, because otherwise we wouldn't know who he's talking about. So he says everybody's fine, everything is fine, and hopefully everything will continue to be fine. Written on the 22nd day of Iyar, that's what it says, while the express caravan is on the point of leaving, you know, your beloved brother David. Finished. And that's the last he hears of his brother. Now the next letter is the most telling letter, gives us even more. And this is the letter that he writes to Yefet. Yefet ben Eliyahu is a fellow who lives in Israel. When the family came, again, you have to go back to the biography. They came from Spain, Morocco into the hills of mountain regions of northern Africa, eventually get to Eretz Yisrael. They meet this family who hosted them. They did walks with them. Now, Maimon is still alive. The father's with him. And the Rambam is a young man. And what is he, in his 20s? And they go through trips with Yefet. And then they decide they got to go to Cairo. So they settle in Cairo. Yefet, years later, writes a letter to the Rambam asking for some favor. They have a little trouble in Israel, so he's writing a letter to Yefet. The Rambam's letter back to Yefet describes the things that occurred and how it affected him. But it's also brusque and it's filled with anger. And he takes it out on Yefet. And this is not only revealing the historical thing, but you're getting a glimpse of personality. because the Rambam's not a happy camper. And he lets it out on Yefet. And as I'm going to quote more from this letter than the previous one. Also know this letter is written in Hebrew and therefore has a lot of quotations from Tanakh, because that was the style of writing. Why is it so? Because he was in Israel and Yefet wrote him in Hebrew, so he's writing back in Hebrew. Did Yefet know Arabic? I'm sure he knew Arabic. But that was the language that they dealt with. So I can't say they spoke Hebrew to each other, but certainly they wrote Hebrew to each other. And the Rambam writes, and he's insulted and angered by chutzpah that Yefet's writing with a problem. Why? Because we hit it off. We seem to have made a good friendship when we were traveling and you hosted us, and we thank you. But then he reprimands Yefet. Months afterwards, my father died. I got letters from all over. I never got anything from you. You never reached out to us that such a tragedy occurred to us. Okay, so therefore, whereas usually maybe the Rambam would have written a letter to Yefet thanking him again for the hospitality or this, now he was angered right away. I never heard from you, so I didn't write you. Moreover, now I'm quoting, a few months after we departed from the land of Israel, my father and master, Avi Mori, died. Letters of condolences, blah, blah, blah. You disregarded it. I suffered many well-known calamities in Egypt, including sickness, financial loss, and attempts by informers to have me killed. No word from you. The worst disaster that struck was the demise of the upright man who drowned in the Indian Ocean while in possession of much money belonging to me, to him, and to others, leaving a young daughter and his widow in my care. Now, you might find it all, you know, centered on the Rambam, you know, like, my loss, he lost my money, and now I got to care for his family. All right. For about a year from the day the evil tidings reached me, I remained prostrate in bed with severe inflammation, fever, mental confusion, and I almost died. Basically, which he would describe elsewhere, he was majorly depressed, and he didn't function for over a year. So it did have a major impact when he got the letter stating that David had died. From then until now has passed 8 years. I have been in a state of disconsolate mourning. How can I be consoled? He was my son, referring to his younger brother. He grew up on my knees. He was my brother. He was my student. But it was he who was doing the business in the marketplace, earning a livelihood so I can dwell in security. He had a ready grasp of the Talmud, superb mastery of grammar. It was a joy just to see him. And he goes on to, you know, state the beauty of the relationship. But yet, the loss is unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's a terrifying loss that he experienced. And what we're getting in terms of Maimonides' writings is tremendous. What's very important is for us to realize, he says, if it weren't for my Torah learning, that became my sole delight. And in scientific matters, that allowed me to forget my sorrow. In other words, he applied himself more into scholarship because that was for him the remedy. How should I put it? That helped him recover, because it's not a diversion, but he needed to concentrate on that, otherwise he would still be in depression. So he threw himself into it. Yet, I complain not, except about you. So here we walk together, the four of us, in God's house in fear, trepidation. You did not seek or inquire. In other words, the Rambam he won't let go. He's now back, giving it to Yefet, and he's very angry at him. God knows how much I am distressed by the hard times you mention. That whole matter grieved me deeply unto death. If you were here with me, I would care for you properly, and I would honor and please you according to my ability. And then he ends nicely, God bless you with a son named after your father, and everything should be well. With all the polite phrases, the kind assurances, the way the letter begins, the way the letter ends, it can't hide the bulk of the letter, which we see a glimpse of personality, of anger, disillusionment, depression. This is just a real surprise, but it's a gift that the letter like this comes down through history, and we get something to understand that we normally, I guess, would not understand. The fact that he could recognize depression, because I don't know how much, I mean, there were other scholars of the Middle Ages who describe it, but we have brought it into to the medical science. We understand mental health is part of medical science, and we don't take it as you became abnormal. No, it's a normal part of life. It's how you have to deal with it that's most important. The loss of life and the loss of money, these are the two paramount issues that he dealt with in here. Through the Geniza, we find other letters of people dealing with loss of life, a disruption of life, there's an epidemic, a plague, horrors, panics. I mean, this is common occurrences in life. But the Rambam was very attuned to all these things that happen in the normal support of life. Did the Rambam really resent taking care of his sister-in-law and niece? I don't think so. I really don't. Maybe in that letter, because he's giving it to Yefet, so maybe there. But otherwise, I don't think that's it. What we do see is, how did he deal with it? He dealt with it with more effort in his scholarship. By the way, besides the translation, I do have the entire letter in Hebrew, because that's the way it was written. So it's an amazing piece of literature, which gives us the glimpse on the inside. It makes this lecture possible to have an understanding as to how he had to deal with it. He stayed angry. He stayed always in a state of mourning. It was always lingering about. You know, I once talked to a family here. I'm close to the fathers. Now it's a grandfather, and they lost a child when the child was young. And of course, at the time, they were devastated. So I asked them,